From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
It's Obamacare repeal round 5. With a deadline of September 30, will Republicans get it done this time? What will happen if they do? And how did Republican senators get themselves into a fight with Jimmy Kimmel? We'll discuss. Donald Trump called for a global nationalism at the United Nations. Does his vision of cooperation based in self-interest make sense? And what does it mean for hotspots like Iran and North Korea, the latter of which he threatened to totally destroy? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Harvard Law Professor Cass Sunstein will teach us about impeachment. His new book is a timely primer on the subject. And Katie Tour of NBC News, or Little Katie, as the president calls her, joins us to discuss her best-selling memoir, Unbelievable, which is her account of covering the Trump campaign. That's all up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. We're going to get to Trump's big speech at the UN, where he threatened to totally destroy North Korea. And later in the show, we're going to talk about impeachment. But first, an Obamacare replacement is on life support again. Senate Republicans are taking another run at something they're calling repeal and replace of Obamacare. But as we tape on Friday, Senators John McCain and Rand Paul have said they cannot support this latest version, with several other Republican senators wavering. The Cassidy-Graham bill would take all of Obamacare's spending and turn it into a block grant to states, who would have 2 years to figure out how to spend the money starting in 2020. Overall, the bill would cut hundreds of billions of dollars in healthcare spending, and it would also give states broad flexibility to change how their health insurance markets work. This would include the freedom to let insurers charge people extra based on their health status, a point that has gotten Senator Bill Cassidy into a fight with ABC's late-night host Jimmy Kimmel. Months ago, Cassidy himself came up with the idea of a Kimmel test. He'd only support a plan that would protect people like Kimmel's young son, who has a heart defect as they seek to obtain insurance throughout their lives. Rich, what's the rationale for this 11th hour push?
Well, one, they want to actually do something that they can portray as repealing and replacing Obamacare because they promised it for so long and they're under a lot of pressure from their supporters and their voters. Two, it is a less prescriptive and less centralized approach than Obamacare, even though it leaves a lot of the spending and a lot of the taxes and the regulations essentially in place. It would give states more flexibility to go their own way within limits. And this is where I find the freak out over the bill unpersuasive. A lot of the critics just seem to assume that if you send money to a state, it vaporizes and nothing happens to it, and states will be happy to just throw people off insurance rolls and kick the sick into the gutter. And that's just not true. I mean, if that's the case, you know, we wouldn't have public safety because states are responsible for public safety. We wouldn't have education because states are responsible for education. So it's a rushed process. It's frankly an indefensible process, hardly ideal. It's the whole thing has been distorted by the various rules they need to get around to do it through reconciliation. Not sure it passes, but it doesn't. This will still be a live option in several months if they want to pair it with tax reform when the next so-called reconciliation window comes up, or perhaps next year.
You know, I pick up, I think Rich said indefensible. I mean, there's political desperation in this effort. It's, you know, these legislators, Republican legislators, went back to a recess where they didn't really do town halls. They don't do those. But they met with supporters and donors. And there's a desperation to get something done. But if you vote to reorder 1/6 of the U.S. economy, which this bill would do, without a Congressional Budget Office score, never call yourself conservative again. You are a dangerous extremist. To me, what's interesting in the past week, Josh, is you see a stark difference between Republicans and Democrats on health care. It couldn't be clearer. You have the poison of Graham Cassidy, which is as alarming, as toxic as previous repeal and replace efforts. And you have the Democrats, many of them, Bernie Sanders with 16 other Democrats, putting forth a Medicare for All bill. One party is saying, you know, scramble, get all the health care you choose to afford if you can. Democrats beginning to understand that affordable health care should be a fundamental right. And I think that is a very stark signal about what these two parties stand for.
Rich, I see a certain arrogance in the way that Republicans are approaching this. I mean, the president was the one who said who knew healthcare could be so complicated, but it seems like Republicans in Congress are acting without feeling any need to think deeply about how healthcare markets work, how insurance would work, without having any estimate of how many people would be able to get coverage, what that coverage would entail, even if they don't like the CBO estimate. It's not like they have their own that they're waving around. And when people say things like you said there, which is basically, well, you know, why can't we trust states to do this? We had health insurance markets where these matters were left to the states prior to Obamacare in the years 2013 and earlier. And what we found was that health insurance markets in the individual market, people who didn't get it through work or through Medicaid or whatnot, that they were very dysfunctional, even more dysfunctional than they are today, tens of millions fewer people with insurance. And in most states, they did allow insurers to deny people or charge people more based on their health status. And the reason for that is what we've seen with Obamacare, which is if you're trying to build a system where insurers have to sell to everyone, including sick people, that gets very expensive to make work. Because for obvious reasons, insurers prefer to sell to the healthy than the sick. If you want them to sell to the sick, you're going to have to put in a lot of money in subsidies. You're going to have very specific regulations. And so it's complicated. Republicans haven't bothered trying to figure out how those details will work. And I think because these block grants are smaller than the amount of money that's being spent now, and because healthcare is so expensive, you will see a lot of states stripping away those provisions because the cost of making a pre-existing condition guarantee work in the way that most voters want it to work are so high, they won't be able to do it with the block grant.
Well, one, on the arrogance point, I think it's more been disorganization born of a certain political desperation. It's been a stop and grow process when it's been rush, 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 give up, rush, 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 give up, rush, 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 give up. And they're now considering, you know, fairly substantial changes to this bill and even some minor tweaks that are important that they don't want to do, because they don't think the CBO would be able to do the score by September 30th, this completely artificial deadline driven by parliamentary considerations. So even some of the architects of the bill aren't happy with its current form, but want to preserve it just to get some sort of CBO score. And
isn't that arrogant process, to say that it doesn't matter if the bill is deeply flawed?
What's arrogant is that you have Republicans basically not minding that millions go without health insurance. And they're assuming that low-wage, moderate-income families should have less health care protection than the wealthy. And, you know, Rich mentioned the tax stuff. That's now going to be tied possibly to another iteration. I think for the Democrats, let me put it this way, politically, if you want to talk politics, and Rich is talking politics, because there's a desperation underlying this drive towards September 30th to show something to donors, to big supporters. But the Democrats are going to play this as hard as they can. They have in Medicare for All an aspirational goal that they will unite around. And boy, do they have in big pharma, health insurance companies, foes and adversaries they need to point to. Now, you also have sanity, as you've followed the Republican governors, right? You've had a block of Republican governors come out against, and you still have the fight. You know, the Alaska sellout you've written about, Josh, right? I mean, they've carved out so much to get Lisa Murkowski. It's craven.
Although they haven't gotten her.
They haven't gotten her, but they're still at it.
Right. As we tape, Lisa Murkowski is undecided.
So I don't know what Rich's wager is on this, but boy, this is going to resurface. It's the Frankenstein bill.
But it's more generous than the past bills. And this is one of the things that's bizarre about the CBO scoring. You can spend, repeal all of Obamacare spending. You can, repeal some portion of it, or you can keep most of it. And the CBO score on how many people lose insurance is almost always exactly the same. And that makes
no
sense.
We don't know what the score
would be.
Well,
it'll very likely be exactly the same, because if you repeal the individual mandate, the CBO says, 15 million people disappear from the rolls immediately, never to return. And I don't think that makes a lot of sense. That's more driven by their model rather than reality. And just on folks with pre-existing conditions, let's be honest, the Obamacare system has not worked well, because if you throw those people into the general insurance pool, it distorts the system in all sorts of ways. You make health insurance less attractive for young and healthy people. Then you need to fine them to try to get them to buy health insurance. But that fine is so politically unpopular, it can't be steep, it can't be rigorously enforced, and you get the current system, which is not working well at all. So a more rational approach.
The bill leaves states free to let insurance companies charge higher premiums to people with pre-existing conditions.
They have to
seek a waiver. And instead of sabotaging Obamacare, we should try to build a healthcare system that works for millions, not undercuts. I think that's why, as Josh prefigured, Jimmy Kimmel has really been a vehicle for the frustrations, the anger people feel about many legislators, in this case Republicans, it's not always Republicans, but in this case, just not leveling with people, not telling the truth, people feeling that they're being shafted. I mean, Medicaid, which has often been treated as health care for the poor, I mean, this bill will enforce deep cuts in core Medicaid programs, which impact millions of seniors, people with disabilities, mothers with children. So I just think Jimmy Kimmel is a wonderful lightning rod for this moment because he's reflecting what so many millions feel. And, you know, the late
but
night
the
host
states,
has had a long tradition.
Again, let's be factual. If the states want to repeal those regulations, they have to seek a waiver for that from the federal government. And there's a standard in place that you have to have some other way of taking care of those folks. And arguably, the better way is to get them out of the insurance pool and just accept the taxpayers are going to have to spend a lot to take care of those people. And then you make the you hope to make actually insurance affordable for the average consumer.
Hope,
but there are two things about this.
Hope doesn't fly in our politics.
No, it makes it makes sense that if you have less people in the sick people in the insurance pool, insurance is going to be cheaper for everyone else, and it's a core problem of Obamacare that it hasn't taken account of this reality.
This is a line that you hear from conservatives all the time, and there are two problems with this approach. One is that, you know, when you say that there are rules about around the waiver, what it is that states have to express an intention to protect those people. It doesn't set a sufficient standard of adequacy, and when you have an administration like this one that is eager to issue waivers, deregulate the market, allow insurers to price as they wish, it will be easy for states to get those waivers even when their systems end up being inadequate to protect those people, because we've seen what those state-based systems looked like before Obamacare came in, where you had these high-risk pools that conservatives like to talk about. The problem is that covering people with serious chronic illnesses is really expensive, and it becomes a huge burden on state budgets, and you can say, if those people have those costs, it should be put on the government ledger instead of being cross-subsidized by other insurance subscribers. The problem is then when you end up with the immense numbers of tens of billions of dollars that it costs every year to do that, and you try to get states, which can't do deficit spending, to cover that cost, they come up short, they impose enrollment caps, they set extremely high premiums for those high-risk pools, and those people end up not being able to be covered. Even if you do cover them that way, it's just a shell game. You're just moving the money that's paid as an implicit tax through insurance premiums into something that's financed by explicit taxes. It fixes
right,
a problem
because,
that isn't
because,
really a problem.
Because more affordable insurance means more to you and is more important. It's sort of a parade of horribles, the case against this bill. The states aren't going to want to cover people with pre-existing conditions. They're going to go to the feds, who are going to be so desperate to give them any waiver, even a waiver that doesn't really address the problem. And then these people are going to be left to die in the streets. And no one in those states is going to care.
Could I step back for 1 second? I mean, value the policy discussion here. But I do think Graham Cassidy, again, I come back, tells us much about the Republican majority. It's emblematic. It's a signal piece of legislation that GOP legislators don't mind that millions go without health insurance. And while Republicans, to paraphrase Michelle Obama, were going low, Democrats were going high. And I think Democrats are now moving forward, and I think in a fairly strategic, pragmatic way, which you wouldn't know from the media coverage, to begin to provide universal coverage for all. I think conservatives should appreciate the cost control in Medicare for all, while progressives, Democrats appreciate the access, the coverage.
We're going to take a quick break. Later in the show, Cass Sunstein joins us to discuss impeachment. And up next, Robin Wright describes Donald Trump's first visit to the United Nations. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine, and on the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Let's talk now about Donald Trump's visit to the United Nations, where the meeting of the General Assembly is occurring. And for that conversation, we're going to be joined by a special guest, Robin Wright. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, you were at the UN this week. How was this General Assembly week different from past weeks?
Well, it was defined very much by Donald Trump's speech on the opening day on Tuesday. And what was striking most about it was the confrontational tone, both in dealing with the flashpoints of the world, but also in the kind of approach to what U.S. diplomacy is. He talked about totally destroying North Korea if it continued to be a threat to American interests. He talked about Iran as a reckless place and implied that the U.S. was, in effect, looking for some kind of regime change. He talked about the potential for a military action in Venezuela to help restore its very troubled and fragile democracy. And I think what was so striking about listening to the speech were the kind of murmurs that went across the room in the U.N. General Assembly, a couple of gasps, and the sense that the U.S. is changing very much the kind of tone from the Obama administration, but also the substance. And, you know, this is coming at a time that the Iran nuclear deal is probably the most significant non-proliferation agreement in a quarter century, whether you like the terms or not. It does provide for a way to deal with Iran's nuclear program. And what was so striking about the week was he was talking about walking away from the Iran deal at the very time he's looking for North Korea to make a deal. And so the speech was riddled with the kind of contradictions and, I think, open-ended questions that a lot of delegations have about what's next? What does, if we walk away from the deal, does policy like Iran look like at a time that, for the first time, 191 of the 193 countries who were members of the UN support the deal? I sat in the lobby of the UN Plaza Hotel watching the president of France, the foreign minister of Britain, the leading Austrian and other delegations parading through to hold court to pay to meet with President Rouhani of Iran. So there's this contrast between the world thinking we've got a deal and Donald Trump saying, well, we may rip it up.
I want to play a bit of sound from the speech where he sort of lays out the big, broad vision that underlies a lot of the things that he said about specific countries.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first. All responsible leaders have an obligation to serve their own citizens, and the nation state remains the best vehicle for elevating the human condition. But making a better life for our people also requires us to work together in close harmony and unity to create a more safe and peaceful future for all people.
So, Rich, this I think of this as a global vision of nationalism. Does that make any sense as a theory of the world?
Well, first of all, this is a speech where Donald Trump was effectively accommodating himself to America's leadership role in the world in a way that some of us feared he would not. You know, it didn't seem implausible during the campaign that he might turn his back on NATO if he were president of the United States. And here he is challenging the UN in various ways in the speech, but accepting it. And the tension in the speech is the point you're getting at. He talked about freedom. When he criticized North Korea, Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, he criticized their internal political and economic systems, which doesn't seem to make sense if you're making national sovereignty the overriding principle of U.S. foreign policy. He tried to square the circle with the standards he set out for what any sovereign nation or any true nationalist should do, which is one, respect the interest of his or her own citizens, and two, respect the sovereignty of other nations. I think this is a standard for nationalism that's not drawn out of thin air. A true nationalist should respect the right of other countries to govern themselves, and as a practical matter, modern nationalism grew up hand in glove with the rise of popular sovereignty. Nationalism was the alternative to rule by dynastic monarchs and prelates and various empires. So that standard makes sense in theory, but it's something that needs to be worked out more. And I don't think sovereignty itself can bear the weight of being the overarching principle of American foreign policy.
So Donald Trump has used his speeches on the world stage to royal diplomatic convention, and he did it again. I mean, this was defiant, pugilistic. It was also incoherent ideologically. I mean, the tension between national sovereignty and universal rights has thrummed through the United Nations work ever since the organization was founded. And Trump did not so much resolve that tension as pretend that it didn't exist. I mean, his 21 references to sovereignty were clearly for the base, it seemed to me, but also ideologically, I mean, there was selective sovereignty. Some countries got more sovereignty than others, right? I mean, Venezuela, we're going to do regime change. Iran seemed to be in that category too. But in other instances, Trump outlined a far more expansive role for America. So this tension within his administration, if there is real thinking about all of this, is this internationalist globalist versus this sort of Stephen Miller, now out, Steve Bannon, nationalism. And you could feel that because he's paying homage to the Marshall Plan. He's paying homage to nation building in certain instances. And then he's very selective in his view of bad actors: North Korea, Iran, Cuba, Syria, Venezuela. You could see this new axis of evil, but China and Russia, for many reasons, not touched. So
I
think
they
were touched, but very obliquely. So I think it was a incoherent speech. I also think, and Robin alluded to this, you know, it's kind of, we shouldn't allow the enormity of what just happened to not sink in. I mean, he did kind of declare war on three countries. I mean, he declared that he was going to quite wipe off the map, North Korea.
If,
now, that is a zinger that got
it. If we have to defend ourselves.
Hopefully it wouldn't come to that.
But in any case, it was a speech, I think Rich mentioned this, it sort of appealed to all kinds of constituencies, from the Washington Post to the Wall Street Journal to Elliot Abrams to all of these neocons. John Bolton was ecstatic, as I read it. And it's a very different than many leaders because of the tone in large part, but he still touched on these sort of diplomatic notes that any president has to.
Robin, what was the reaction to these North Korea comments? Now, for those who haven't heard it or read it, he said, "The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime." That's, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the right to self-defense has long been part of U.S. rhetoric about North Korea, but that sort of totally destroy rhetoric and name-calling is new with this administration.
One of the problems was that there wasn't much of an alternative outlined. There's the idea of, well, if North Korea completely abandons its nuclear program, gives up all its missiles, then there won't be any kind of confrontation. But there didn't seem to be a middle ground. And one of the things that's really frightening is when you look at the potential for a war with North Korea, what we're really talking about: tens of thousands of dead in Seoul alone, more than 1 million casualties in South Korea. And that's the conventional war, which would probably play out on a matter of weeks, but it's really phase two. And what happens after that, if you totally obliterate the North, totally destroy, as he said, we're engaged in regime change. And that means that, first of all, we'd have to create an alternative. And as we learned in Iraq and as we're still learning in Afghanistan, that's really hard to do. And it can involve trillions of dollars and very long military deployments and the deaths of thousands of Americans. And, you know, the danger is also that in phase two, we get into a process where we're fighting the kind of insurgency we did with the North Vietnamese, that you find that those who believe that Kim Jong-un and the Kim dynasty really do protect those in the North, that, you know, they're engaging in a kind of guerrilla war that's ongoing. And then the bigger danger, of course, is what about China? China looks at North Korea as a buffer for its borders. It doesn't want to see a reunified North Korea. It doesn't, and it's prepared, you know, to tolerate a good deal of the North Korean activity or misbehavior as long as there isn't an aggression. It doesn't want the program to develop, but it does not want to see regime change either. And so are we going to put ourselves in a position that we are confrontational with China? And this is where, if we're looking for China to be the major player in all of this, the one that convinces Kim to back down, we can't go in guns a-blazing, even if it's just rhetorically. That limits the ability of the Chinese to want to cooperate. And it the kind of rhetoric we saw in New York also endangers that the North Koreans will say, well, you see, we really did need these weapons, and we need to actually escalate our campaign to protect ourselves.
But I could, if I could say one quick thing, which Robin is an expert on. I mean, on the Iran deal, if the United States decertifies, pulls out, you have the Europeans who will continue to abide by it. It is probably the most important diplomatic nonproliferation agreement in recent history. But if the U.S. suddenly decides to unilaterally pull out, how could the North Koreans be convinced it's worth their while to sit down to negotiate anything with the Americans? So you're going to have a proliferation crisis of Iran starting up its nuclear program, and the proliferation crisis, if not worse, of North Korea.
Well, the interesting thing there is you have that difficulty, but then you also have the Trump administration sort of trying to project a more united front this week, talking up China's increased cooperation on banking sanctions with North Korea, appearing jointly with the Prime Minister of Japan and the President of South Korea. The President had in recent weeks been sort of, for no good reason, sort of saber-rattling at South Korea, sort of trying to make it look like there is some sort of diplomatic push that is stronger than in past weeks, even at the same time he's saying this, you know, totally destroy stuff. Rich?
Well, as a practical matter, I mean, North Korea is sprinting as fast as it can towards having the capability to put a nuclear weapon, an ICBM, and nuke Seattle. They are doing that. It doesn't matter whether Trump calls him Rocket Man or Mr. Kim, he's doing that. He's desperate to do that for all sorts of reasons, and he's not going to stop. The history of negotiations with North Korea is they use them for their own purposes, to buy time, to get resources, while they continue to pursue this capability. So I think the question is not whether he should be more polite in his word choice, it's what the administration's strategy is. It's still not clear what exactly the red lines are. It's still not clear what the departure is from the conventional approach to this problem, which is you hope China is somehow going to see North Korea your way, when, as Robin points out, it has a strategic interest that involves seeing it an entirely different way. I do, though, think these sanctions are a step in the right direction. We have this image of North Korea as the most sanctioned country on earth, and therefore there's nothing more that can be done. There is, and we need to start pushing even more down this line towards secondary sanctions. And I think the policy that would make sense is to say, we're done dealing with this regime. Our long-term goal is regime change, the way to pursue that also will serve the goal of a robust policy of deterrence and containment in the short and medium term.
Can I just say I've been to North Korea, and I don't think that the idea that you're going to see the North Koreans rise up against their own leadership is a viable alternative. Sanctions may squeeze the regime down the road, but this is where we're not trying to engage diplomatically to find a way to say, look, okay, don't move any further, freeze your program, and we'll figure out a way to deal with you. This is what was lacking in the speech. It was either, you know, you give up everything or we're going to go to war, and that's neither strategy
is likely
to work.
You admit they're not going to give it up because they never will. And all these prior deals to freeze the program haven't worked. It's not revisionist.
You have a revisionist history of the history of diplomacy with North Korea. We don't have time to go through it, but there was progress made with tough diplomacy, aborted under George W., and as we've seen with Libya, with the invasion of Iraq, acquiring nuclear program became more important. If you suspend the deal with Iran, I think you do a surge, and instead of a diplomatic surge, there's no military resolution to the North Korean crisis. As Robin said, there are really very few alternatives, and regime change, I think, is insanity.
I've been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Robin Wright of The New Yorker. Robin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back to talk about journalism in the era of President Trump. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine, and on the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. We are now joined by Cass Sunstein. Cass is a professor at the Harvard Law School, and he's just written a book called Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. Cass, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So what I find to be a key takeaway of your book is that you think most everyone, including members of Congress, misunderstand what the founders intended impeachment to be for. So what is impeachment for?
Impeachment's for very serious abuses of power. So it's closely connected with the American Revolution, that fighting and conquered that started the independence of our country. This is very much connected with impeachment. The idea is if someone acts kind of like a king, invades liberties, abuses authority, that's when the impeachment mechanism kicks in. And a crime may not be sufficient for impeachment. And if you haven't committed a crime, you still might have done something that is impeachable.
So this is one thing I found interesting about what you wrote. You say that, you know, the two times that presidents have been impeached, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, neither of them had committed an impeachable offense. And you even say that one of the charges the House was considering against Richard Nixon related to claims that he had evaded taxes was not truly an impeachable offense. So is it that any crime that's not directly related to official duties is not impeachable, no matter how serious? Like, what if a president murdered his wife? Would that still not be impeachable?
That's the extreme case. Murder would be an abuse of presidential authority necessarily. So you could imagine just a purely private murder. And the history is actually a little murky on that one, but I think we should understand the Constitution to make sense. And in a case of murder, probably we should say that that's so extreme. But the general view that emerges from the 18th century is that we're really not talking about something that a private citizen could do, certainly not income tax fraud, shoplifting, jaywalking. Even though all of those things are crimes, they aren't the sorts of things that a president can get to do because of presidential powers. And that's really what Madison and Hamilton and the rest were focused on.
And then the flip side of this is things that aren't crimes that can be impeachable. And I think that's what people have interest in right now, because it seems likely that impeachment's going to be at least a significant theme in the 2018 midterm campaign. You've started to hear rumblings from Democrats about the idea that Trump should be impeached. Is there a case there?
Well, I wrote the book actually partly because there was a book about President Trump that was impeachment focused, and I thought it was a terrible book and a very political book. And what was needed really is a book that abstracts from any particular president and thinks about what our constitutional system is like. That's kind of inspiring. And to think about, you know, whether it's a political mechanism used on a Thursday is not helpful. Now, if you have conduct, whether it's by, you know, President Clinton or President Johnson or President Kennedy or President Nixon, that is not criminal, but is an abuse of authority or a gross neglect of duty, definitely that's impeachable. So if a president says, I'm going to go on vacation in Paris for the next 6 months, see ya, that's impeachable because it's a gross neglect of duty. If you're a president who says, I'm going to pardon everyone who has engaged in certain kinds of criminal behavior, James Madison actually signaled pretty clearly in the ratification debates that that's the kind of impeachable offense that the whole thing is for, even though exercises of the pardon power are not themselves criminal.
And so apply that to President Trump then. Is there anything to be applied here, anything that he's done yet?
Well, I prefer, you know, to have a neutrality, meaning not to go after the current occupant of the White House and not to speak about him, because that violates the neutrality principle. It tends to get people thinking, do I like him or not? But I'm happy to talk about particular forms of conduct that could be impeachable. If you have a president who starts pardoning people in a way that didn't reflect kind of an all things considered judgment about whether they should be prosecuted, but instead is an effort to insulate the White House from investigation, then we're getting toward the domain of the impeachable. Obstruction of justice by itself is not necessarily impeachable. So if you obstruct justice in connection with an investigation of your own, let's say jaywalking or shoplifting, that's not impeachable. But if you're involved in obstruction of justice with respect to what might be underlying impeachable conduct, and here, you know, think of President Nixon, for whom that's probably an apt description, then we're in the domain of the impeachable.
Katrina, what do you think about this as applied?
I wanted to pick up on what Cass was saying about President Nixon. Elizabeth Holtzman, who was on the House Judiciary Committee, which voted to impeach President Nixon, has written that, you know, impeachment is not quick or easy. And she talks about how the Constitution, and I'm sure Cass does in his book, sets a high bar for impeachment and removal, treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. A president cannot be removed simply because people disagree with his or her policies. But do you, Cass, find a useful roadmap in the Nixon impeachment effort? There are so many parallels being drawn in these times between what we're witnessing with the Trump administration and Watergate.
Oh, completely. So the Nixon impeachment, fortunately, the Republicans won in making sure that income tax count did not get a majority vote. The Republicans were completely right about that. Nixon had $400,000, apparently, of non-payment by the IRS when he was president. That's pretty terrible, but it's not an impeachable offense. And the fact that the vote went the other way is a nice roadmap. On the other hand, the count that actually attracted very strong support within the committee was abuse of the apparatus of government to invade mm-hmm. liberties, abuse of the CIA, abuse of the IRS, abuse of the democratic process. And there were really talking. We're going back to what was said actually in Massachusetts as a vindication of the impeachment power, that if you start invading people's civil rights and civil liberties, then we're talking about something that's kind of like a king. The one that is slightly harder, but not all that hard, is obstruction of justice in the form of use of the apparatus of government to prevent an investigation of something that's an independently impeachable offense. Now, that's not as crystalline clear as the civil liberties and civil rights violations, if you're with me, but it's pretty close to clear that to use the apparatus of government to prevent a lawful investigation of what would be impeachable offenses if the claim was true, there were probably in the domain of high crime and misdemeanor. And notice misdemeanor doesn't mean, you know, a small non-felony crime. It's not that. It means bad act. And Hamilton, you know, pretty good guide for the meaning of the Constitution, talked about abuse of public trust. And if you're not allowing a fair investigation of something which is itself an impeachable offense, then Hamilton's ghost is nodding.
Rich, what do you think about this standard that's sort of divorced from criminal law?
Well, I have two questions for Cass. And first of all, congratulations on what sounds like a very thoughtful book. But one, if you're a member of the House voting for impeachment, should it be a consideration at all how likely the impeached official is to be actually removed in the Senate? Because in the case of Clinton, outside of whatever you think of the merits of the case against him, it basically worked as a censure because the chances of removing him were always extremely remote. So what the House really ended up doing was just putting a black spot on his record. That's one question. The second, if you don't mind, is I know you don't want to get into specifics about Donald Trump, but a defense you already hear from his supporters is he had the legal power to fire James Comey. He has the legal power to help draft a statement about Don Jr.'s meeting with various Russians and to make it misleading or evasive if he wants to. But your counter to that would be actually that it is his legal powers isn't necessarily a defense. It might mean it's actually in the heart of what would be impeachable, depending on what his motives were and whether those motives were corrupt or not.
Okay, great. And those are terrific questions. So impeachment has a kind of gravity, and seeing it in light of the 18th century, where I spent much of the last months, it's really an inspiring thing. And, you know, it doesn't matter what your political party is, it's what America's really about, which is that we're governing ourselves. And that really answers your first question, which is if a member of the House of Representatives thinks, for example, that President Clinton is impeachable, that's the conviction, then vote for impeachment, even if you think there's no chance the Senate's going to go for it, because that's your constitutional duty, given your conviction on the facts. Now, in terms of any president, let's say, to abstract from the current one, it is not an adequate answer to a claim of an impeachable offense that the president had the legal authority to do what he did. The president has legal authority to fire, you know, basically the cabinet and a lot of people under the cabinet, and the president has the legal authority, certainly, to pardon basically anyone, probably not himself, but basically anyone else. And both of those issues actually were squarely discussed in the constitutional debates where exercise of the, and Madison's our guy, Madison suggested that use of the pardon power, which the president has, is impeachable under certain circumstances. And the same thing is true of exercise, and Madison said this early in the Republic, of exercise of the discharge authority. So the president has a lot of power here, and his exercise of it ordinarily is not impeachable. But under imaginable circumstances, in fact, Andrew Johnson was impeached, I think wrongly, but was impeached for firing the precursor to the Secretary of Defense. And that's if the motivation takes a certain form, say insulation from a lawful investigation of impeachable offenses, or if the pardon power is exercised so as to cover up some terrible wrongdoing which the president was in some way involved in, then we're back to the American Revolution, really.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Again, the book is called Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. Cass Sunstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Now we're going to talk with someone who has arguably more firsthand knowledge than anyone about journalism in the Trump era. Katie Turr of NBC and MSNBC was the first network news reporter to be assigned to cover candidate Trump full-time. She's written a memoir about that experience called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. Thanks for joining us, Katie.
Hey, Josh. Good to be here.
So first of all, congratulations. I believe you're number two now on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list.
Second only to one other person, but I'm surprised because no one really knows who she is.
That other book about the campaign.
So has my birthday also beat me in the book race.
Well, as we learned this year, coming in second can sometimes still count for coming in first. So I think a sign of the sort of mental space that you've taken up in the president's head is that you got a nickname, or at least you got to share a nickname with Marco Rubio. He was Little Marco, and you were Little Katie.
Little Katie, third-rate reporter.
So what was it like covering a candidate who sort of kept drawing you into the story, whether you wanted to be part of the story or not?
It was weird. Obviously, no reporter wants to be a part of a story, especially a part of a story that was at times trying and even scary as the Trump campaign could be. But it started from the very beginning, the very first rally I ever went to, before anybody was taking him seriously, before any other real reporters were covering him consistently. I was standing around a backyard pool where Donald Trump was giving a rally speech in New Hampshire, and it was just a couple hundred people. And Josh, one of the first things he says, or I guess in the middle of his speech, he takes a weird detour and then says, "Katie, you haven't even looked up at me once." And I remember thinking, how in the world does he know my name? We've never met. But that was how the campaign started, and it was this thread that ran throughout the entire thing. Him trying to charm me into more favorable coverage, and then when I wouldn't give him what he saw as more favorable coverage, he would go on the attack. And it bounced back and forth.
So you're describing it there sort of as a strategy. How much of this do you think was strategy versus pique? I mean, the president gets into these feuds. Sometimes it just seems like he's mad. But then sometimes, you know, as you're describing there, there seems to be a real goal behind it.
Well, I think he went after the media on purpose. I think Donald Trump is somebody who works on a gut level. But his gut level is actually, he's pretty intuitive on how things work. So when he went after the media, I think he understood that would inoculate himself from harsh criticism, and that people wanted to yell and scream at somebody, and reporters are easy to yell and scream at because our job is basically to make you uncomfortable. I think that was strategy. Going after me in particular, I just think he is somebody who does what he wants to do in the moment he wants to do it, and I was one of the most familiar faces to him on the campaign trail. I was there from the beginning. He saw me in rally after rally after rally after rally after rally when it would be just me and a bunch of local reporters from wherever we happened to be on that day. So I think that it's hard to attribute a lot of foresight on Donald Trump. He just tends to act.
So one thing we've seen, as you know, as Trump made the media one of his key enemies in the campaign, we've seen a real polarization in public opinion about the press. Now, Republicans had a fairly negative view of the press on average even before this campaign, but it's gone down farther. Less than 15% of Republicans saying that they trust the mainstream press. Trust has actually gone up a lot among Democrats. What does that leave for reporters like you and for news outlets like NBC News to do, especially as they're being drawn into this story? What are the pitfalls, and what do they need to do to try to maintain that trust across the spectrum?
It's a really difficult question, and I don't have the silver bullet answer for it. I don't think anybody does. I think part of it is reporters need to build more relationships with just average voters and viewers or readers across the country so they can get to know a reporter on more of a personal level, understand where they come from, understand how they do their jobs, and understand that we have a pretty high standard for what we can put on television or what we can write in a newspaper, understand attribution, understand sourcing, understand vetting, understand the process by which something gets reported. That's kind of lost in the mix. I think a lot of it had to do with what you said. No politician likes reporters, period. I mean, our job is to shine a light on them and to uncover what they don't want uncovered, or to fact-check what they don't want fact-checked, or to correct spin. And so it's difficult, but we had decades of very harshly the right-wing media, right-wing radio, right-wing television, right-wing politicians going after the quote-unquote mainstream media, saying that we're liars and we're Democrats and we're liberals, and that we always have a certain bent to it. And that seeded itself in the minds of a certain portion of the American electorate. And that's going to be hard to undo. I think the best way to do it is just to continue being a tough journalist, but being tough fairly, being tough on both sides, not a false equivalency, but having the same set of high standards for both Democrats and Republicans.
Isn't Trump right when he says that the media is by and large full of people who didn't think he should be president, don't think that he is up to this job? I mean, even conservative newspapers by and large across the country didn't endorse him.
Well, I think a lot of people said that this man is not qualified. And I think that was a sentiment that was across the board for much of the country, including conservative radio pundits, including Fox News, including early on, at least, including Republican candidates. Donald Trump didn't have a lot of experience. He would say things that were not true often. He would go on the personal attack in a way that nobody's ever seen before. In terms of just sheer qualifications for the job, Donald Trump didn't necessarily have them. He didn't have what everybody else had going into office. I think it was frustrating being a reporter on the campaign trail because you would correct him. You would fact check what he was saying. You would talk about the tape that came out, for instance, and it didn't seem like any of the facts of what we were reporting mattered to Donald Trump's supporters. And that's
sort of the catch 22. Like if you have a candidate where you're making essentially a fairly objective case about their lack of qualifications here, and yet there are tens of millions of people around the country who like him a lot, think he ought to be president. Is there any way to do reporting on him that those people will trust and not view as adversarial and therefore
no,
biased?
There's not, and that's what made it so difficult. No, I mean they wanted to believe that Donald Trump would fix their lives. And anybody who was going to tell them otherwise was someone who was not to be trusted. They want to believe that Donald Trump is the change that they have been waiting for, which is why you're consistently seeing this hard base refuse to acknowledge, even when he can't get things done in Washington. His approval ratings have gone up again because of storm coverage, essentially, because he has appeared as if he's reacted empathetically to some of the storm victims. He's toward damage. But realistically, he hasn't gotten anything done in Washington other than the storm aid package. He hasn't passed major legislation. The travel ban is held up in the courts. There's going to be changes to that now. He is not uniting the country when he talks about Charlottesville. He's not doing things that you would expect a president to do. He's not doing things that he sold himself as being able to do. I'm the only one who could fix it, he would say, Josh. But he's not fixing it. And his voters don't seem to care about that because they want to believe in him.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Again, the book is called Unbelievable, and congratulations again on all the success with it, Katie.
Josh, thank you so much. It's nice to be on the other end of this for once.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Berkeley had to spend $600,000 on security for a speech by Ben Shapiro on campus, which is an inordinate amount for anyone, especially a mainstream conservative who is not alt-right. In fact, has been viciously targeted by the alt-right. It's just another sign of the crisis of free speech on campus that it requires establishing a mini armed camp to protect a dissident voice from physical violence.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your rant?
Too often over the past years, I've heard that progressives don't have big ideas on foreign policy. This past week, Bernie Sanders took to the same stage where Winston Churchill delivered his famous Iron Curtain speech almost 70 years ago, and Bernie's challenge to the progressive movement was to redefine for the 21st century a principled, bold vision for America's role in the world. Foreign policy is not just about whether we go to war or not. It's about our democracy at home. It's about climate change. It's about global oligarchy. Sanders rightly linked domestic and foreign policy. Look at the Pentagon's bloated budget, he said, while Republicans renew their attempts to take health care away from tens of millions of Americans in the name of, quote, fiscal responsibility. Check out the speech. Check out our take on it at thenation.com.
Robin Wright, what's on your mind?
The Cassini spacecraft. I was so struck by the magnificence of the pictures and the scientific discoveries of this NASA program. And I was struck as well by the fact we're spending all this money, all these trillions, and fighting other nations and spending so little of our energy, our focus, our resources on finding out more of our place in the universe.
Katie Turr, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is infrastructure and being prepared for massive storms that we're seeing happen more frequently, not only in this country, but across the world. I want to know why we can't make sure our major cities are prepared for a major hurricane, why they're not prepared for a major tornado, why we refuse to acknowledge that for every dollar we spend on preparedness, we save $4 on recovery. Why can we not have the foresight to make sure that we are ready for a storm rather than just reacting to it?
For my rant, London is denying the renewal of Uber's operating license. Uber has brought down the hammer on itself by being a bad corporate citizen and by elevating executives who are cartoonish jerks who draw attention to themselves. So anti-competition forces are pouncing, taking advantage of Uber's bad press to protect the interests of incumbent taxicab owners who, in London, charge drastically high prices compared to Uber. Uber's appealing this decision, and perhaps an outcry from consumers who like Uber for its price and convenience will save them. But the threat to Uber's business should be a lesson to business leaders everywhere about the costs of being a jerk. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Katie Turr, Cass Sunstein, and Robin Wright. Laura Zine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.